You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Support for today's show comes from Citizen. Isn't it time you saw the light? Citizen makes watches that are powered by light, any light, and will never need a battery. So stay on time with Citizen's collection of Echo Drive watches. They're for just about everyone who prefers to be on time. Visit citizenwatch.com/podcast for more. That's citizenwatch.com/podcast. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you send and receive calls and texts from your new business phone number. That way, you can run your business from anywhere and respond to clients quickly with Grasshopper's mobile apps. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. That's grasshopper.com/kick. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. In the summer of 2000, the most decorated soldier in Israel's history, Ehud Barak, set himself a challenge as daunting as any he had faced on the battlefield: to secure a final peace with the Palestinians. He would propose two states for two peoples with a shared capital in Jerusalem. He knew the risks of failure, but he also knew the risks of not trying, letting slip perhaps the last chance for a generation to secure genuine peace. It was a moment of truth, one of many in a life intertwined from the start with that of Israel. Born on a kibbutz, Barak became commander of Israel's elite special forces, then army chief of staff, and ultimately prime minister. He writes about it in a new memoir titled My Country, My Life: Fighting for Israel, Searching for Peace. Today he comes on the podcast to discuss his early years growing up on that kibbutz in Mishmar Hasharon, and how even as a boy he felt the significance of Israel's founding and wanted to play his own role in her destiny. He admits that as a young man he didn't quite fit the physical profile of a military hero, but he quickly found that his brains and skills were just as valuable to the IDF as raw physical strength, leading him to become head of the nascent Israeli Special Forces unit, Sayed Maktal. He recalls leading a daring mission to rescue hostages on a hijacked Sabina flight in 1972, the soldier-turned-one-day political rival who served under his command, and his own transition into politics after 20 years in the Israeli military. He discusses the 2000 Camp David summit, his initial impressions of Yasser Arafat, and why he believes Arafat was never sincerely interested in a peace deal. Plus, he shares the biggest regret of his political career and why he's changed his mind about the Iran nuclear agreement. Coming up with former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak in just a moment. Ehud Barak served as Israel's prime minister from 1999 to 2001, during which time he worked to engineer a sustainable peace between Israel and Palestine. He was the leader of the Labor Party until 2011 and minister of defense, as well as deputy prime minister in Benjamin Netanyahu's second government from 2009 to 2013. Before entering politics, he was a key member of the Israeli military, occupying the position of chief of staff and playing key roles in some of the most pivotal covert and military actions in Israel's history. Now he discusses his remarkable life in his new book titled My Country, My Life, Fighting for Israel, Searching for Peace. Ehud Barak, it's an honor. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, you say that as much as this book is about your own personal story, it's equally about the story of Israel. There's no significant moment in your country's history that doesn't intersect with your own history. In a way, it almost seems like you and Israel grew up together.
Yeah, I happened to be born several years before the country, and even as a young kid of 6 years old, in a remote kibbutz, kind of communal settlement, pioneer settlement, I was fully aware that something dramatic that never happened since the biblical times is happening in front of our eyes. And since then, you know, I watched the War of Independence as a kid, but later on, in 59, I joined the armed forces. And since then, by some luck or accidental kind of development, I found myself the focal point of many of the most kind of interesting event that Israel had been through, including the wars and several operations and so on. And when I ended up after 36 years, it's not a short time, as a top general of the armed forces, Rabin and Peres asked me to join their government. And I became Minister of Interior, then Minister of Foreign Affairs, and within a few years, the Prime Minister of Israel and its Minister of Defense. So somehow, because Israel is very compact and history is not controlled by us, I really found myself in interesting crossroads.
Yeah, I should certainly say so. What was your childhood like growing up on that kibbutz in Mishmar HaSharon?
It was on one hand extremely deprived situation. My parents' room was a 12 on 10 feet room. No running water, no toilets, no shower, and not even a bed for me. You know, I was brought up in a nursery home for babies, as well as my brothers in different nurseries around the kibbutz. It was like a permanent summer camp for adult people. but at the same time, there was a great sense that, you know, all the kibbutzniks are basically pioneers serving a case much bigger than themselves, beyond their life expectation. And it's so important that it justified some of the sacrifice to share everything they had. There was no private property there beyond probably your watch or your pen. Everything was shared by all. So I brought up in an extremely socialist kind of atmosphere. And when you look at socialism from very close distance, you learn, even in an early age as a kid, many of its limitations.
Even as a boy, were you conscious of the significance of Israel's founding and that you and the other kibbutzniks were, in your own special way, part of a larger purpose?
Very much so. Totally different from the situation right now. Individuals 60 or 70 years ago in Israel, we all felt at the service of the greater cause, bringing once again Jewish sovereignty on our promised land. And it was clear when the war opened, you know, there was no fighting in my kibbutz, but I watched it through the newspapers and the radio. And it was a dramatic event of historic magnitude. It was clear that every passing days you are witnessing something unique.
You say that you didn't think that you had a very promising military career at first because apparently you weren't a very physically imposing young man when you joined the IDF.
As a young boy, I was extremely introvert, shy, not athletic, contemplative, avid reader, and I preferred playing the piano over basketball or any other field activity. And my mother or my father would never say that I would turn into a one of the founders of Israel's equivalent of SEAL Team 6 or Delta Forces long before those units came into existence. No one would have predicted it, but it's sometimes it come out of necessity. There was so compelling awareness of the need to build the country through fighting, because we were surrounded by enemies, that almost deliberately I turned myself into someone who will be capable of serving the great cause in the way which is most imminent and needed, which is being an officer or a commander of fighting force.
Right. You're an example of how intelligence can be just as valuable as physical strength in the Army. Wasn't it your navigation skills that helped you rise through the ranks?
Yeah, that's why. In fact, I studied to navigate through some youth activity that was encouraged by the Army. At the time, you know, no GPS, nothing. You could be lost, especially at nighttime, if you didn't know where you are. But I found very fast that I always knew where I am. I could read maps. It was quite easy for me. I was quick in the numbers and very clumsy in the big movements of the body, and very, very fine and accurate in the small movements of the fingers and so on. I knew how to pick locks out of experimenting with locks and with pieces of steel. That was the kind of accident that brought me into the embryonic Special Forces Unit of Israel.
Yeah, you became commander of the Special Operations Unit called Sayet Maktal, which was something totally different for Israel, and it didn't really operate off of the same playbook as the rest of the military. What was Sayet Maktal?
It was totally different. This was a very small unit, very more remote, based on the tradition of both the British Special Air Service, the SAS. It was the model for us of a commando unit, and some legacy from the undergrounds of pre-48 war, the undergrounds of the Jewish. We call it Jewish community in Israel before the British mandate ended. So basically, we didn't wear uniform. We used to use the civilian clothes. We called our officers by their first names. No distance, no kind of any special respect. Everyone was measured only by what he can perform. It was very kind of a free spirit kind of unit. We basically educated ourselves, and we were a very small unit. When I came in, there were less than 20 soldiers. And we educated ourselves to admit no limits to what could be performed, no limitation, sometimes not even the limits of the law.
And what kind of missions did you lead at Sayet Maktal?
We kind of enjoyed in the kind of juvenile delinquency stretched into adult life for young soldiers. We basically aspired to do whatever it takes to protect Israel. But for several years, until I became an officer, there was no operations. The time was a relatively quiet time. Ben-Gurion, for many reasons, almost never allowed us to cross the border. So it took some time, but it was a unique atmosphere. Mm-hmm. I cannot compare it to any normal service in uniform.
Sayet Maktal was skilled in the arts of subterfuge, disguise, strategically thinking outside the box. And a good example of that is when you led Operation Isotope, a mission to free hostages on board a hijacked Sabena flight in 1972. Tell us what you did there.
So it happened that one evening I just got a call from the headquarters in Tel Aviv, where a general whom I knew told me Sabena airplane 707 had been hijacked and is now brought to Israel. It will land in 20 minutes. Come as fast as you can to Ben-Gurion Airport. The time it was called Lod Airport. So I came there, also found the generals, and within a short time, it became clear that, first of all, we have to paralyze the airplane, that it won't take off suddenly with all the hostages. So I was sent to together with a technician of Fel Al to neutralize the capacity of this airplane to take off without letting the captain or the terrorist to observe it. So we came, the engines were still working, and we crawled behind it, came under the hull of the airplane and neutralized its hydraulic systems, and it kind of sank a little bit, but it couldn't turn the nose wheel. And within several hours, I had some 30 soldiers of mine with some six or eight officers. And we arranged to take over the airplane by jumping on the wings and opening the emergency doors. It was a mission that we never been performed ever in Israel. We never trained inside an airplane. We just took an airplane in the hangar, another similar airplane, the Boeing 707, and we trained ourselves for half an hour how to open the emergency doors from the outside of the airplane and enter. And we planned just to shoot the terrorists once we are there. But it became clear that they have explosives and hand grenades and weapons on them. There are four of them. So to cut a long story short, it was only the next day that we decided, disguised as a airport mechanics with white overalls and the mechanical tools and whatever. I led the rescue raid with some 14 of my officers on the airplane. When we stormed it, it took 90 seconds, after which the shooting was over. We killed two of the terrorists. We captured the other two. Saved all passengers but one, and we had only one officer slightly wounded from a shot that came from one of our guys. The name of the wounded, the young officer, was Benjamin Netanyahu, the present prime minister. He was a young officer under my command.
Yeah, Benjamin and Yoni Netanyahu served under your command. What were your impressions of the Netanyahu brothers back then?
You know, in fact, not just them. The younger brother, Ido, also was under my command at the same time. Yoni, the elder brother who later was killed in Entebbe in 76, he was both my deputy in the unit and also one of my closest friends. He even bought an apartment, one floor under my apartment, the same residential building, and we were very close. They were ambitious, capable officers, the two elder Netanyahu, the Yoni and the Bibi. Bibi was more practical, Yoni was more contemplative. I would sometimes go down on Saturday morning to see him at his apartment. You might find him in a rocking chair with a book of Yeats or Nietzsche or Schopenhauer, reading, having a pipe. And
really?
He was interested in a wide areas of thought, of philosophy, of poetry, and many other issues. And he was more emotional in a way. But they were both capable, extremely capable soldiers. In a way, I sometimes joking that I'm responsible for all the problems that later Israeli politician got from Netanyahu, because I tried to convince him to stay as a career officer. He could make a good general. But he insisted on going to MIT to study architecture or something like this. And he left.
You later served as defense minister under Netanyahu, and more recently you've become one of his most vocal critics. Is Benjamin Netanyahu a very much different person today than the one that you knew when you were heading up Sayed Maktal?
Look, first of all, I was also the only person who defeated him in the ballot, in election.
Right,
know,
that's true.
Came
right
after Peres and pushed him out of power.
Yes.
But later, as you mentioned, I was a minister of defense, both in Olmert government and in Netanyahu's government. He developed, and certain traits in his character became more and more dominant as a result of its long exposure to politics and so on. Basically, he's not a lightweight. He's a thoughtful person, knowledgeable, and kind of with a lot of experiences as a politician. He gradually developed a mindset of deep pessimism, passivity, anxiety, and self-victimizing kind of mood. That's quite good recipe for politics, because, you know, if you don't initiate anything, no one can blame you for something that gets wrong. And if you are compelled into certain behavior by circumstances, you can always argue that, okay, I'm not a demigod, I had no choice and whatever. I would say that his mindset is a good recipe for a survival in politics, but is a very poor one for statesmanship. And I think that we are missing opportunities. For decades, we used to criticize our Arab neighbors, saying, especially the Palestinians, as our legendary foreign minister, Abba Ibn, used to say, the Palestinians never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. I hope we will not adapt or not adapting gradually this pattern of missing opportunities.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak when we come back in just a minute. Hey folks, let me tell you about a company I love. We use them for our 800 number, and if you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, you really need to know about Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you run your business from your cell phone while keeping your business and personal lives separate. Choose from their huge inventory of local, toll-free, and vanity toll-free numbers. Simply forward your new number to your mobile phone and start taking calls immediately. Whether you're in an office, in your car, or out running errands, Grasshopper's iPhone and Android apps help you stay connected to your customers. Not to mention, you can send and receive calls and texts from your business phone number, set up multiple extensions for everyone on your team, get your voicemails transcribed and emailed to you, work from anywhere with call forwarding to make and receive calls from your computer via the desktop app, and even utilize Wi-Fi calling. Better yet, Grasshopper offers easy and instant setup and 24/7 customer support, all without any long-term contracts. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. That's grasshopper.com/kick. And now, back to the podcast. And you had a rather remarkable political ascent. You were elected to the Knesset and became leader of the Labor Party in 1996. And within 3 short years, you were prime minister. How was that quick transition from military commander to politician?
In Israel, when you serve at the top of the military, you are part of the decision-making process on the top political echelon. There is no clear-cut separation between the two layers. So I was exposed to the decision-making process at the high level for 20 years before I became prime minister. I was deeply involved as a top general in the army under Rabin, Shamir, and Peres, Mishas. I was deeply involved in the peace process with the Jordanians, in the Oslo negotiation with the Palestinians, even in the attempts of Rabin to find a way to strike a deal with Assad, the father of the present Assad. So nothing was new for me in a way, but I was still a man of uniform. I was for too short time in politics. You know, in the armed service, you somehow assume unity of purpose. It's part of what you take for granted. In politics, you have to schmooze, to caress politicians' egos, and to invest a lot of energy in just holding the group together, because you cannot assume unity of purpose. The personal agendas are easily taking over. So in this regard, I was not kind of experienced enough. It was beyond my control. Basically, it was activated by the fact that Rabin asked me to come immediately after I left the army. And I tried to defend myself. I tried to tell him, Yitzhak, why it matters whether I come after 36 years or in service or 38 years. I was here. I joined a think tank here in K Street, CSIS. It's a leading think tank. I joined it very much. I wanted to stay for 2 years with my wife and the young daughters here, but he told me, Ehud, he had a vast profound attitude. Ehud, in politics, you never know what might happen. I need you now.
Yeah.
So I came, became his minister of interior, and he for sure didn't mean that he's going to be assassinated within 6 months, and that is the unpredictable event. So I was sucked upward. Immediately I became a minister of foreign affairs in Peres government, and when Peres lost election, I immediately was sucked up into the role of leader of labor, and then, you know, even then, yeah, there was a legend that Bibi is unwinnable. So I told them, don't tell me any legends. I know the guy for 30 years. I was his commander. I know him very intimately. Just make sure that the playing ground is leveled and make sure that you are ready to work as hard as as the other side on politics work, and we will win. And that's what happened.
And as prime minister, probably the most significant moment during your term was the 2000 Camp David summit. You say in your first meeting with Arafat, even before that, you told him that you wanted to move as quickly as possible toward final status talks. He didn't want to do that. Why not?
First of all, you could never really negotiate with him. He was a storyteller, kind of. He was always somewhat enigmatic. He never answered your concrete questions with concrete technical answers. He would also talk in parables. He'd tell a story, and then you have to break your head or put your brain to effort to try to guess what he meant by this. And you cannot impose him to start to talk tachles, as we say in Yiddish. So he basically didn't respond. He was very evasive, may I say, elusive in a way. But my argument was very clear. When I came to power, we were already 6 years after signing of the Oslo Agreement. We were 3 years after we committed ourselves, both sides, to start permanent status negotiations. And the European Union already contemplated unilaterally recognize a Palestinian state next year. And most important, President Clinton, who was deeply involved for the last 6 years in this negotiation, was about to end his second term. And it was clear to me that it will take whoever will be elected half a year, probably a year, to shape his policies and to become as knowledgeable and understanding of the nuances. And by then, we might face violence. In fact, I warned our public. I described this as two families living in a cottage, metaphorically, we and the Palestinians were on the same piece of ground. And a fire is going to develop there. And the two householders, myself and our father, are coming from both sides to put down the fire. One of us even already have medals of world leading firefighters. That's Arafat with the Nobel Peace Prize. But you never sure if it's not the arsonist with the gasoline and the matches in his pocket. So it's there was no way to know it, no way to penetrate it by through this daring attempt at Camp David. And because I was confident from long before that the alternative, if we are not acting to try to clarify where he stands, we will anyhow end up in violence. I saw that the only rational behavior or logic behavior of myself could be to push toward this moment of truth, even if the truth that we would find won't be the one we wish for.
And even after Camp David, you were still talking with Arafat, and you felt that you might still have good prospects for some beginning of a peace agreement. And then, of course, Likud leader Ariel Sharon made his infamous visit to the Temple Mount, and rioting erupted in the West Bank in Jerusalem. Was that the final nail in the coffin of a peace deal?
I'm not sure. I never blamed him for this. Really? In fact, I could try to block him from doing it, but there was the only reason legally that I could impose upon him not to visit was to get from the Secret Service or from the police an opinion that it is risking public safety. Mm-hmm. But at the time, none of them felt that it risked the public safety. So, in reality, when he visited, nothing happened. You know, there was some exchange of shouts between him and some Arab members of Knesset, Israeli Arab members of Knesset, deliberately came at the same time. But the whole eruption of violence happened only the next day. So I cannot tell you honestly that without his visit there would be no eruption. I predicted anyhow that the eruption will come. Probably it was the trigger that made it happening at that date and not 2 months earlier or 3 months later. So basically this was not the cause.
Well, you resigned as prime minister shortly after that. And I have to say, I've always wondered why you chose to do that rather than call elections and try to form a national unity government. Because if you had had elections, say, in the spring or summer, it would have given you at least another 2 or 3 months in office to work on a peace deal. What was your thinking in choosing to stand down?
In a way, my second greatest mistake as a politician beyond and not investing much more time in schmoozing and caressing my colleague politicians, was not to accept Sharon's proposal to establish a national unity government after the Second Intifada erupted. Usually that's the right moment for Israelis to join hands and fight together, because in case of violence, we are all united. But Sharon, in the negotiation, was ready to everything, made a lot of compromises, but he insisted that we have to announce formally that the peace process of Oslo is dead. I thought that this is a grave mistake, because we couldn't have a breakthrough with Arafat, but at least we proved to the whole world that Israel was the party who was ready to make to take painful decisions, and the responsibility for the failure is on the shoulders of Arafat. We were holding the moral high ground, which provides the source of unity in within and support from the world in the coming clashes. Yeah. And Sharon insisted once and again that it's a precondition, we should cancel it. What I was too naive at the time to realize, that the fact that he made it a precondition doesn't mean that he meant it. You know, I could say, yes, we establish the unity government. We go into common kind of life as a government. And he would ask, how comes that we don't pass this decision? I would say, okay, next month. That, you know, in politics, and as friends of Sharon told me later, you shouldn't assume that he really means it. He just has to say it. He cannot enter a new government humiliated without at least having this demand. And as everyone knows, only 9 months later, there was a 9/11, which changed the world forever. So, you know, it's a kind of mistake that probably had been done out of being, I call it, over-normative. That's not the right way for a politician. Probably I learned the lesson. But basically, I do not regret what I have done. All things were done on my responsibility. It reflected always my best judgment of what's good for the country, not what's good for Barack's survival in power.
And later, as defense minister from 2009 to 2013, you were intimately involved in deciding how to deal with the Iran nuclear threat. You were originally against the Iran nuclear deal, but you say now that your thinking has changed since the deal was put in place. Do you think Israel was better off with the deal than without a deal?
You know, I was more than just against the deal for several years, from 2009 until 2012. For a sequence of 4 years, I was more hawkish than Netanyahu or Lieberman about the need of Israel to prepare and be ready, having the political will and the operational capabilities to hit on the Iranian nuclear program, and probably delayed by 4 or 3 or 5 years, depends when we would have hit. And we, for different reasons, could not, which are detailed in the book, we could not do it then. And when the deal came, I thought it's a very bad deal, But once Obama signed it, it became part of reality. I didn't change my mind by that. Don't think that in real politique you have to deal too much with hypotheses about or speculation about what would have happened mm-hmm. if a different trajectories would have been chosen. Mm-hmm. So it's reality. The same applies to the decision of President Trump to pull out of the deal. First of all, the deal is still there because Europeans are there and the other parties. I thought that the issues kind of created the bad behavior of Iran, namely keep developing missiles, or spreading terror, or executing insurgencies in neighboring countries. These are all elements of bad behavior of the Iranians, but they were never part of the deal. So the more proper or natural way to deal with it would be to convince the European to start a new round of negotiation, leave this deal alive with its benefits and probably weaknesses, because it's part of reality and it cannot be changed by American pulling out unilaterally. Mm-hmm. And start negotiation about those elements. Mm-hmm. Raise the demand that the Iranians will stop developing missiles as a different element. But once again, once the president took a decision and pulled American out, it becomes senseless to discuss what would have happened if he would take a different path. Mm-hmm.
Do you buy this rationale that the more erratic President Trump behaves, the more restrained and cautious Iran or even North Korea will be for fear of what he might do next? Does that logic make sense to you?
I should tell you that in regard to this decision, we can see after a few days the consequences. On one hand, because this administration is totally unpredictable, especially now with Pompeo on one side and Bolton on the other, no one in the world can guess what will be the next step. That calls for certain cautiousness on behalf of the Iranians, and they probably will exercise certain moderation out of their inability to judge what might follow. Mm-hmm. And even their suspicion that probably now that America is out of the deal, the administration might be waiting for the slightest Iranian mistake or a step that might appear as violation of the agreement, and America might go after and use their military capabilities for certain surgical operation against the nuclear facilities. Yeah. So basically they are worried. I expect them to be more mm-hmm. cautious.
This is a little out of your sphere of expertise, but have you given much thought to how this might impact potential peace talks with North Korea?
When they start to negotiate at the more complicated moment of such negotiation, which will appear inevitably, Kim Jong-un might argue what sense it makes to sign an agreement with America if you sign it with one president, the next president can wake up some morning and decide to cancel it. So what kind of, you know, the rules of the game in the world were based on the commitment to keep and respect signed agreements.
Yeah.
so it's quite problematic. In the short term, it will impose more moderation from Iran, as it did from Kim Jong-un. I think that part of Kim Jong-un kind of closer, warmer relationship with the South stem out from his inability to judge what the administration might do. He already reached his nuclear capability. He has a small arsenal of A-bomb and probably two or three or one hydrogen bomb. He already completed the tests. I don't believe that he will dismantle his nuclear arsenal or his ballistic missiles arsenal. But the most he needs or wants, it's probably a pause in the uncertainty. And you're ready to pay with certain promises. So he promised only to stop testing. He doesn't need any tests because he already knows the technology. And you know, for him, you should understand, the whole nuclear project is not in order to attack South Korea or Japan, not Guam, not to mention Seattle or Washington, D.C. It's basically about insurance policy for survival. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to share the fate of Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein, who gave up at certain point their nuclear military mm-hmm. programs and ended up being beheaded several years later.
Last November, you said you are, quote, more ready and qualified to lead Israel than all the other candidates around, including Netanyahu. Are you contemplating a political comeback?
No, I just made an objective observation about realities. Yeah. I edited the continuation of this same interview. I said that, you know, it cannot come to a simple test because we are not running against each other these days. We changed the political system since mm-hmm. I defeated him in the polls. Mm-hmm. And that I am fully aware that my I don't have the sentiment even of my own camp behind me. You know, I have disputes with the right wing in Israel, but I respect from them. I cannot yet convince my own camp that to relieve them from the scars of my short period as a prime minister who dared to do what no one else dared, and it ended without a peace. So I said basically that you can never say never in politics. And I prefer not to enter politics.
Yeah.
I cannot deny that under extreme situation, I could imagine circumstances where I will be compelled to consider coming back mm-hmm. to politics. But because I know what kind of scenario it means, I prefer that we will never reach yeah. there.
Before we go, if I may, I just want to quickly ask you, because I'm a movie fan, about Munich. You said that you're hesitant to contradict Spielberg's account of that story because he cast a much better looking man to play you. But you do say that he got a few things wrong about that operation. Like what?
Oh, it's so many, not for a short discussion.
Okay.
See the movie and then read the book and you will see for yourself the difference. I cannot say that it's not a good movie, but the reality is more nuanced.
Absolutely. Well, definitely read the book then. It's called My Country, My Life, Fighting for Israel, Searching for Peace. Ehud Barak, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks once more to Ehud Barak for coming on the show. Order his book, My Country, My Life, Fighting for Israel, Searching for Peace on Amazon or Audible. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.